You are Locked On MLB. Your daily MLB podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
Hello, baseball fans, and welcome to Locked On MLB, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day. This is the daily podcast. We talk about all of Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully. On today's episode, I have the unbelievable honor of having Emmy Award-winning, brilliant writer, author, and father of a professional baseball player, Mr. Brian Kiely, who will be talking to us about baseball, talking about the minor leagues, and whatever comes into our craniums. This show is available on the free and easy-to-use Himalaya podcasting app. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts, and you're staying at home during these, oh, let's just call them interesting times. Be sure to tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On MLB, or check out some of the other great shows on the Locked On Podcast Network, including Locked On Fantasy Baseball with Scott Cullen, and Locked On Red Sox with my dear friend Gabrielle. And you can follow us on Twitter at LockedOnMLBPod. I'm your pal Sully. I'm at Sully Baseball on Twitter. Sully Baseball Podcast on Instagram. So I just got to say this right here and now. When I first started doing stand-up comedy in the mid-1990s, and I was not very good, and there was a couple of shows I did where some of the writers from Late Night from Conan O'Brien would show up from time to time, and they were all very, very good. And one of them became my friend and someone who I've always looked up to and admired. And as he has gone on for a very successful career writing and is also a very big baseball fan, and he is my guest here, it's Brian Kiely. Thank you for joining the show.
I'm so delighted that you have me. Thank you so much. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, too. Yeah, I mean, just I'm not going to get too into cabaret stand-up comedy in New York in the mid-1990s. But it was you and Janine DiTullio were the two comedians when almost everyone on the show were people like me were just at that point. I was only doing it for probably at that point a few months. And you would go up and Janine would go up and you had those great credits that you were writing for Conan O'Brien at the time. And the only way I can describe it is I saw Ken Griffey Jr. play in single A. And it was so obvious that Ken Griffey was better than everyone that he was playing around. And you and Janine would go up on stage and you'd be so much better than anybody. It's like, oh, that's a major league comedic talent there. So if you're keeping score at home, I am comparing you to Ken Griffey Jr.
Well, people always call me the kid. It's
interesting. Yeah. So we're both native New Englanders.
Yes. Yes. I grew up in Newton, Mass. Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Weston, Mass, which is like one town.
Oh, Weston.
Yeah, I grew up in Weston. Yeah, so.
Sure.
And neighbors. Yeah, and we both were quite familiar with the Red Sox of the 70s and the early 80s and everything like that.
Yeah, sure.
My
upset. You know, I don't know if you had this. When I was 13 during the season of 1975. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was maybe 2015. We'd be watching the Red Sox game, and they'd say, "In this date, such and such happened." And one game, they go, "Rick Wise beat the Brewers 6-3," and I was like, "Guys, Rick Wise had a no hitter with two outs in the ninth inning, and he walked a guy named Bill Sharp." Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember this game. And then George Scott came up and homered. And then the next batter was Bobby Darwin, and he also homered. Although Fred Lynn, like, you know, sometimes it has to go to the certain side of the line for it to be a home run or whatever.
Right? It's like,
this was actually, I think this was in County Stadium.
Okay.
But whatever, and I was just listening on the radio, so I don't know how it hit, but Fred Lynn swore that it didn't go over the line, mm-hmm. that it should have been double.
Right.
And he's yelling at the umpire, and I remember Ned Martin saying, "Fred Lynn is hopping mad." And I never heard the expression
"hopping
mad."
I've seen this clip.
I've
seen this. I never knew the context, but I remember Ned Martin said, "And Lynn is hopping mad," and he was going bananas. Oh, my God, yeah.
Well, so it's so funny where, and they would do that, you know, every day. They'd say, remember this great game. And I didn't, you know, and the ones that I saw either on TV or the ones that I heard on the radio, I remembered like it was the day before. Now, when 86 came around and I was in my mid-20s, mm-hmm. they would do the same thing the next year on 2016. Yeah. And I did not have that kind of recall. And it's just so interesting how your brain works. You know, you're as a 13-year-old, mm-hmm. your brain is empty. All I knew was Red Sox, and that was all that was in there, you know. But then when you're 25, 26 or whatever, you've got other things going on, and you're older, and you don't retain things like that, you know. I just remember the 75 season so much more vividly than the 86 season.
Well, it's funny. I was 14 in 86. I'm a little younger than you. So I was 3 in 1975, and my main issue was watching Zoom and Romper Room. But
sure.
My earliest Red Sox memories were in 78, but I have a thing on this podcast, and people who follow this podcast know I talk about this to death. I call it the rule of seven. And the rule of seven is around 7 years old is when you first really start following a sport and you really start understanding the flow of the games and everything like that. And so while I remember the 78 squad and players like Bill Lee and Tiant and George Boomer Scott and everyone like that, I didn't really understand the flow of a pennant race. And thank God I didn't in 78, because that would have been a brutal way to be introduced to it.
Sure.
I just thought, based upon the baseball cards that I got at the time, is that every team plays a season, and then at the end, the Yankees, Royals, Phillies, and Dodgers are allowed to play in the playoffs, and no one else is allowed to play in it. It didn't even occur to me that the Red Sox would be allowed to play in this invitational. I remember the 79 season, which also my first grade teacher in Weston was named Mrs. Bresciani. And her husband was Dick Bresciani, who at the time was the statistician of the Red Sox and became vice president and historian. And she knew I liked baseball at that age of seven, you know, in first grade. And so I had my stacks of Topps baseball cards, and she told me what all the numbers meant on the back. And so that was like unlocking the Stargate. It was like all of a sudden everything clicked. And from that moment, all those random numbers it was like learning a language. And I could understand why this player,
sure.
you know, why did Rod Carew have the little all-star banner across his name and Juan Benitez did not, you know, I understood what it meant and everything. And so the 79 season, when they went back to the Blue Hats that year, and that was the year Yastrzemski got his 3,000th hit and his 400th home run, and Fred Lynn probably should have been the MVP that year. He was remarkable.
He was.
That year, I remember vividly. But 86,
right.
That year, forget it. I could tell you the minutiae, everyone who was called up from Pawtucket for a day, who was brought in as a pinch runner, how often they used, you know, Jeff Sellers, you know, all these, like, the most obscure Red Sox and everything. That 86 team, I remember that like a year. But you said you were 13 in 75. I was 14 in 86. So that really was
right.
It's that era.
Well, it's funny because in the 67 team, mm-hmm. it was just it was too early for me. But I, you know, so I don't really remember that, but I do, they have those games on the radio. They have those radio broadcasts on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So a few years ago, I listened to the 67 World Series in my car, and I have this strong memory, and I don't remember who hit it now, they said, but it was, but Yaz threw somebody out at the plate. So here it is, 50 years later.
In the World Series? Okay, I don't know who won.
I think he threw out Lou Brock at the plate, but I could be wrong about that. But he did throw. Somebody who's on second base is a single to left, and Yaz throws the guy on the plate. And I'm driving in my car listening to this on my phone, and I'm pounding the dashboard in delight. You know, it's like, buddy, it was 50 years ago. They lost the World Series that year, you know, whatever. But in my mind, it was like, it's like you're listening to the radio a live game while you're driving. You know,
you don't have to. You don't have to apologize to me. I listened to the a couple of years ago. I listened to the entire 1980 National League Championship Series between the Phillies and the Astros. Arguably the greatest postseason series ever played.
Yeah,
it was.
Yes, Terry Poole was hit like 500
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, but was picked off when he was the potential pennant-winning run that he got picked off at first in the ninth inning of a tie game where if the Astros scored, they would go to the World Series. I mean,
oh my God!
I remember at one point because I was driving that year for family reasons, I kept driving back and forth between Los Angeles and the Silicon Valley. And so I wound up listening to a lot, you know, three ball games, you kill half the trip right there. And And I remember I was driving and I must have been near Fresno listening to one of these games and by myself listening to a game that took place in 1980. And I wound up yelling out loud in my car to nobody, how the hell did they lose this game? And it was great because if you don't know the minutiae of it, it just seemed like the Astros are going to win the pennant. They're winning in the eighth with Nolan Ryan pitching. How did they lose? And lo and behold, they did.
Well, now I don't know if this happened to you, but for me, see, when I went to college, people were just getting VCRs, but my family didn't have a VCR then. And my sports knowledge really took a big dip those 4 years of college because you're in this other world, you're in this bubble. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any way of recording the games or whatever. So it's like, you know, you do trivia and when you get to those years, it's like my knowledge takes a big dip. Because I was in school and yeah. I had too much other stuff going on, you know. I was drinking.
That's where you and I are different because I didn't drink and I wasn't paying attention in class. I was still following baseball in college. So, but yeah.
Right.
But yeah, by the way, I've talked about this before, but of all the broadcasts, the television broadcasts and radio broadcasts and everything that I've listened to, like classic games, I had someone ask me what classic game should I listen to, and I think they were expecting me to say like, you know, the game 686 or you know one of the Yankees Red Sox games in 04, and my answer was game one of the NLCS in 1979 between Pittsburgh and Cincinnati, and the reason I say that is A, it's an exciting game, it's a 10 inning game where
did Seaver pitch?
Seaver pitched. And John Candelaria pitched for the Pirates.
Pittsburgh.
You still had Joe Morgan was still on the team. Johnny Bench was still on the team. George Foster was on the team. Pete Rose was gone, and the Pirates had you know Bill Madlock, Willie Stargell, Dave Parker, Omar Moreno.
Sure.
Great team. The reason I say that is the broadcast itself is done by. Joe Garagiola, Tony Kubek, and Don Sutton, and the three of them are perfect. They just the back and forth, the descriptions, the game itself is exciting, and it has one of my favorite calls of all time, which I'll probably mangle a little bit here, but it was in Cincinnati, and this was actually the Rule of Seven. I was 7 years old. I actually remember this postseason, so this is maybe part of it is my own nostalgia, but.
Sure.
Willie Stargell hits a home run in the 10th or 11th inning, three-run home run to give the Pirates a three-run lead on the road. And it was one of those when Stargell hit home runs the same way Mo Vaughn later hit home runs for the Red Sox, and I called them camera breakers, that the camera went straight up and straight down to follow the trajectory. They weren't like little bloops. I mean, they were these massive moonshots that he hit.
Sure.
And this, I think, went into the upper deck at Riverfront. And he hits the home run. He's rounding the bases, and everyone in Cincy knew this game was over. They had a shot to win this. And Garagiola said, "You know, the home run, Stargell, da da da." And these fans are leaving the stadium as if it's on fire. And I just loved that call. That's such a great description. At that point, they're like, "We're done. Get out." And it's just it's really great I mean, Gary Giolo is my favorite announcer of all time, but I just loved it. So I just tell people, watch that. That's just vintage announcing there.
Now, let me tell you something. Betting on the NFL playoffs doesn't have to be a guessing game if you listen to the new Locked On Bets podcast hosted by your boy Q and handicapping expert Lee Sterling. Get daily picks and quick-hitting advice to make the smartest possible wagers. Subscribe to the Locked On Bets podcast brought to you by BetOnline.ag, wherever you get podcasts.
So a few years ago, I can't remember now if it was MLB or ESPN, but one of the networks, they showed the 1960 Game 7 of the World Series with the Pirates and the Yankees.
I saw that. Did you see that? Yes, I did.
And do you know the story behind this?
Well, if I'll let you do the bulk of this, but if I'm not mistaken, it had something to do with the estate of Bing Crosby.
Yes, yes. So Bing Crosby was a part owner of the Pirates. Right. And I guess he owned 10% or something. And he was shooting a movie, I believe, in Paris.
Okay.
So he's going to be out of the country, so he's going to miss Game 7. So he has his butler, or whatever, take his camera, mm-hmm. put it up against the TV, and film the game. So he can come back and watch the full game. So years later, after he died, they're going through his stuff in his estate, and they go, hey, we've got a film of Game 7 of the 1960 World Series where it was – I think it was 10-9.
It was 10-9, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, Mazeroski hits a walk-off homer to win the World Series, mm-hmm. one of the great World Series games of all time. And so they show it, and they had the former players there. They had, like, Roberto Clemente's widow there, and they had former – and they'd show an inning, and Bob Costas would interview, you know. But at one point – I think it was Yogi Berra hits a home run in the eighth inning.
Yes.
And to break the tie. And the announcer says, and it's foul. And then it's like, oh, no, it's fair. And it was such a blown call at that time. You know, mm-hmm. here it is, like such a key moment. And I'm blanking in the announcer's name, but it was one of these things where I had only heard, oh my God, this guy was the greatest announcer of all time, you know. And I think that people kind of wax nostalgically about their childhood and the announcers that they're listening to while they're in bed with their transistor radios and whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was like, oh, that's such a blown call.
In Game 7 of the World Series.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, by the way, that's got to be, I did watch that. Michael Keaton was in the audience because Michael Keaton's a native of Pittsburgh, was a big Pirates fan, big Roberto Clemente fan. There's a couple of things about that World Series that are truly amazing. First of all, the Yankees blew out the Pirates in every statistical category except wins.
Yeah.
Like all the Yankee wins were blowouts.
Yeah, it would be 13-2 or something, and then they'd lose 4-3 the next day. Yeah. Or whatever.
And so would you, in fact, Bobby Richardson, the Yankees second baseman, was the World Series MVP, even though he was on the losing side. It was he's the only person to win a World Series MVP on the losing side. A couple won the League Championship Series, but he's the only one to win the World Series MVP on the losing side.
Oh, is that right? Yep.
Bonds should have when the Angels beat the Giants. Bonds' OPS was like 40. I mean, it was like they had to invent new numbers for how he played in that, but they gave it to Troy Glaus because the Angels won. But that's neither here nor there. But the couple of fascinating things about that was it was Casey Stengel's final year as the Yankee manager, and the Yankees, even though all he did was win, they were trying to find an excuse to get rid of him. Because he was like 70, and he made it for whatever reason, he didn't want Whitey Ford to make three starts, so Whitey Ford only made two starts, and Yankee fans were like, if he made three starts, they would have won. You know, they were stuck not using him in the do or die Game 7, but in that Game 7, the Yankees took the lead on that Berra home run, and
with two outs in the must have been the eighth inning, Clemente beat out a infield hit that prolonged the inning by one batter. And so it's one of those hustle things that doesn't show up in the box score. And the third string catcher who was in there because of injury and pinch running or whatever was a guy named Hal Smith, who in two outs in the eighth inning hit a go-ahead three-run home run to give the Yankees, to give the Pirates the lead and put the Pirates to within three outs to winning the World Series, which if the Pirates held on to that lead, he would have been one of the biggest heroes in the history of the World Series. And instead, he is a super obscure footnote.
And right.
The Yankees rallied in the ninth, and Harvey Haddix, who just a year before made baseball history by throwing 12 perfect innings in one game, only to lose it in the 13th, lose the game. He gets an L for that, you know, if only he pitched better.
Yeah.
There was a runner, Mickey Mantle was on first. There was a line drive, and the first baseman, who, forgive me, I don't remember who the first baseman was. This part of my memory is foggy. I don't remember who the 1960 Pirates first baseman was. But he made the play, stepped on first, and was going to throw to second to double up Mantle and clinch the World Series. And he looked up, and he didn't see Mantle at second. And he looked over. Mantle never ran, did a little head fake, dove back, grabbed first, and the tying run came scampering home. And that's how the Yankees tied it with basically two outs in the ninth inning. And then the leadoff hitter was Mazeroski, who hit the home run over Yogi Berra, who was playing left field because Elston Howard was now the catcher. But the shot of Berra is running up. You see him looking up there. And you've performed all over the place as a comedian. I don't know if you've ever been to Pittsburgh, but at the, I guess it's Carnegie Mellon University there, is where Forbes Field was. And there's a plaque. Oh, wow. There's a plaque where it was the part of the wall that the ball cleared. And straightaway center field, the wall of Forbes Field still exists with the flagpole. And in the student union is home plate, where home plate was. So when my dad and I went there, we were taking pictures of me standing where the Mazeroski home run cleared and me standing at home plate there. So there you go.
Wow.
There you go.
That's fantastic.
We like to keep talk here up to date. We want to really talk about we want to get the cutting edge of what's happening today. So we're going to break down the 1960 World Series one inning at a time. That is amazing, though, that they it's clearing through Bing Crosby's vault that we have. That's the best preservation of one of the most incredible games ever played in baseball history.
And it's funny because they've shown a couple of World Series games. There's one from 52. Mm-hmm. And
I've seen it. I've seen all this stuff.
Yeah. But there's not that many. I haven't seen any of 54 or the Milwaukee Braves against the Yankees or the Dodgers against the White Sox. You know, there's highlights, but you don't see whole games.
They weren't preserved the way they are now. I mean, the videotape technology was not that strong, and you basically had to create, the technology that Bing Crosby's butler had was pretty much what they did. I mean, that's why when you look at like old Honeymooners and things like that, it has that kind of rounded distortion along the side because it's a film camera shooting a cathode ray tube. You know, Lucille Ball was, and Desi and Lucy pioneered a lot of the preservation of television and videotape and everything on their show, which is one of the reasons why there's so many episodes of I Love Lucy available, but just only a handful of other shows from that time. And certainly sporting events weren't there. One of the most famous calls in baseball history is the 1951 Giants beating the Dodgers.
Russ Hodges?
Yes, Russ Hodges. And I did a thing for The Moth that appeared on a television network that doesn't exist anymore called Trio, where I talked about how my dad is a big Giants fan, was a New York Giant Willie Mays fan. And I went to the side of the Polo Grounds on the 50th anniversary of the Bobby Thompson homer, which was less than a month after 9/11, by the way. But when I went there, there was a bunch of guys my dad's age who were there wearing like Giants jerseys and hats. And one of them had a cassette player, and he had the Russ Hodges inning. And we sat around at the moment at like 4:15 or whatever it was. And we sat at the spot of home plate listening to the inning. And we were all quiet, like, we don't know what's going to happen yet. And then we all started clapping when he hit the home run. Well, that was the local announcer, Russ Hodges, who was the announcer of the Giants. There was a national broadcast, which I believe was done by Ernie Harwell, and that does exist on YouTube, that recording of it, and it's a much clearer recording. And the only reason why we have the Russ Hodges recording, that was just going to float off in the air and right now it would be around Neptune, is that it was pure anger, schadenfreude, and wanting to raise a middle finger. That's the reason why we have that. We have it because there was a Brooklyn Dodger fan who knew that Russ Hodges gets really emotional. And he wanted to stick it to his friends who were Giants fans to record Russ Hodges crying the moment the Dodgers beat the Giants to go to the World Series. So he set up a microphone to his radio, hit record, so he can preserve this moment. And then what he wound up getting was, we saw he was emotional, but then he became the Giants win the pennant. And he realized he had this recording of Russ Hodges going bananas when they won the pennant. And so he could have just thrown it out in disgust. But instead what he did is he called up WMCA, which was the radio station that covered the Giants in New York, and said, hey, I don't know if, because they didn't keep it. They didn't record it. And sure, he said, do you want this? And WMCA like bought it for like, I don't know, I'm just going to say, and it was like $100 or something like that. And then they made a record of it, like one of those little single play records.
Sure.
And Giant fan, it flew off the shelves because Giant fans started playing it. And so that's why we have that recording.
Wow.
And there's a Mandela effect that people said, oh, I remember watching that game and I heard him say, Giants win the pennant. Giants. No, you didn't. That was the radio call. You heard the Ernie Harwell TV call and he didn't say that. So,
right. So now there was some controversy a few years, like, right? Wasn't it a few years ago that they discovered that the Giants had this amazing comeback? Yeah. They were way behind, like in July or something.
Oh, yeah. It's called the Miracle at Coogan's Bluff, that they were down by like 14 games with like a month and a half to go.
Right. But however, they were cheating,
yes,
right?
Yes, weren't they
stealing? Yeah.
It was the Astros garbage can of the 1950s.
Yes. And Branca, who gave up the home run, what I had heard is him and Bobby Thompson, they would go to these, baseball shows or whatever where they, signed baseballs and all that, one of those autograph things, and they became good friends. Mm-hmm. Even though, whatever they were, and when it came out, I think it was a New York Times article or something about how the Giants had been cheating those last two months of the season or whatever, that severed their friendship.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, you didn't beat me fair and square,
and you knew all this time. And
he
knew it was like, oh, I didn't realize. Like, yeah, that would do it.
Yeah.
That would do it.
And Ralph Branca, so he was a 20-game winner. Mm-hmm. He was somebody's son-in-law,
I'm doing this from memory, so forgive me if I get it wrong, listeners, but I believe he was the father-in-law of Bobby Valentine.
Yes. Okay. Right. Okay. That's it. Nice. I knew there was something there, but I couldn't remember what it was.
I love like Jose Rio, who won the World Series MVP for Cincinnati in 1990. His father-in-law was Juan Marichal.
Right. Right.
And like the, occasionally That's... there's little connections like that. And
I love that stuff.
Carney Lansford, former Red Sox, former A, former Angel, and longtime coach for the Giants, is, I believe he's a direct descendant of, I believe it was Sir Francis Drake. It's like someone in
really?
Yeah, I'm gonna have to look, but I think it's Sir Francis Drake. And how proud Sir Francis must have been when the A's won in 1989, and he said, my direct descendant is the starting third baseman of the World Series champs. Oh,
he probably wished he was on the Pirates.
That's probably true. Oh,
that's great.
Okay, Brian, we are going to wrap this show up, but I'd like you to come back for tomorrow's show. We'll get you a hotel. We'll get you a per diem. I hope it. We'll get you. We'll have Postmates delivered to you.
No green M&M.
Okay, please. Yeah, you are such a diva. You are such a prima donna. But we'd love to have you back on the show because I really, really, and did I mention really, want to talk to you about your son Sean and his minor league days and his minor league experiences. So, can you come back?
Absolutely. I'd love to come back. Thanks, buddy.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll get your flight information ready. But for everyone else, you can go to the free and easy to use Himalaya podcasting app and check us out on Twitter at Lockdown MLB Pod. If you have anything you want to send for the Sunday request or for What If Wednesday, send it to me at Sully Baseball, which is my Twitter handle. And you can also send it at my personal Instagram handle, which is Sully Baseball Podcast. Talking about current teams like the 1960 Pirates, the 1967 Red Sox, and why I like listening to the 1980 NLCS while driving up the five with Brian Kiley. This has been Locked On MLB. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully.